exception number 27202, real number, Colonel James Dowson, real number 8. We're talking about the treatment of some of the Australian forces. You were saying that you'd go out to clinics for them as well.
Yes, there was a military hospital at Terendak, and it was staffed by British officers, and the Australian forces were committed to assisting with confrontation within Indonesia, which was active then, and also to going into Vietnam, because Vietnam was mounting quite considerably in importance. I think it was Vietnam. They certainly were there in considerable forces.
So how were you getting on with life there? What were your conditions of service like? You know.
Quite enjoyable. Singapore is a sort of major city, and you enjoyed city life. I was going to tell you about getting conditioned. Intolerable heat and humidity when we first got there, gradually it started to we started to be able to cope with it. We got I remember when we first got there, a young woman who was a guest of Harold and Edith, the people I spoke to you about, she came and her hair was wet, and she said the Far East is like a drug. At first you find it really very upsetting, and then once you get used to it you can't get enough of it. And we thought, what on earth is she talking about? But we understood eventually. We got an air conditioner which roared at that time. It's a great big box that roared and dripped water on one side, and we got it in the bedroom, and that made life tolerable, because at least we could look forward to sleeping in reasonable cool conditions. And also we dashed from one air-conditioned store to another. There weren't very many of them at that time in Singapore. But as time went on, we found that we could cope with the heat and the humidity better and better. And eventually we sent the air-conditioner back, because it was always got on higher, and just had a fan to stir the air up. And for the last 18 months or so of life in Singapore, we rarely used air conditioning. It didn't seem to be necessary.
Now, anything you remember in particular from your time out there? Any stories?
And not so much. I suppose they're just the rewards of... A big change in ophthalmic practice was dealing with younger people rather than dealing with older people. I'd done a lot of cataracts, and cataract dominates eye practice in civilian life. And I was doing a lot of younger people, and getting a certain amount of feedback, reassuring feedback from the work I was doing. Nothing military, it's all clinical, really. I remember, you won't mind me telling you these anecdotes, no. Remember in Aldershot, a young woman came in with a big squint, a very unsightly squint, and she was wearing an ATS uniform, which was, the khaki hat and the khaki uniform that didn't quite fit, and the khaki Lyle stockings and so on. She was really quite a mess, and she had this squint, and her glasses, I think, were fastened with elastoplast because they were broken. She couldn't be bothered to get another pair, and she looked really quite a miserable creature, and I operated on her and got her eyes straight. And the standard practice is to see them about a week after surgery or a few days after surgery and then send them away for a long time. It's a good idea not to look at squints too often. You wait for about 6 weeks or so. And I was very busy with recruits, and she had an appointment. I knew she was coming. And very busy with recruits, and I was writing up, because you get a lot of information and you haven't time to write it up. So I was writing away at the desk, and some next appointment came in and sat down. And I turned, and there was this young woman wearing Hardy Amy's uniform, nice new specs and so on, smiling like mad. And I realized it was her. Her eyes were straight. And I said, "My, how you've changed." And she said, "Yes, look." And she pointed at her engagement ring. That was a tremendous moment.
So it really worked.
Yeah. And there were other things as well. There was when I mentioned the Australians, I got some taste of what it was like to live in this sort of remote conditions. They would talk about glasses changes for their children, and you'd see people who had already started treatment for their squint, and they would talk about getting their glasses sort of in a week, meaning that they would put the prescription on the train that went past, and it next came past a week later with the glasses, which were handed out. That was the sort of situation they lived in. And it altered my attitude. I realized that I couldn't sort of behave the same way as I did as a senior registrar in a teaching hospital, where you just wrote out instructions and left somebody else to do them, and it all happened without your involvement. You had to make sure that what you told them to do, they did, and help them to get it done if there was any difficulty. And the other anecdote I was going to tell you about was, again, a young woman who had a terrible squint. And she was the wife of a serving Australian. And I straightened her eyes. And she was complaining when I first saw her about her husband being unreasonable and a heavy drinker and all that sort of thing. And she must have, I suppose, felt inadequate because of her poor appearance with an unsightly squint. But when I straightened her, she straightened her husband out, and she came and told me about it. And that was a tremendous feedback and reassurance that people tended to sort of, and still do, tend to diminish the importance of squints and say, you know, it's only just your eyes are crossed, you don't actually have any visual disability when you've got both eyes open, so it's purely cosmetic. But it's this word purely that I would take issue with, you see, because it's very important for people to look the way they feel, as it were. Or in order to feel the way they want to, they've got to look the way they want to. And those are two examples of that always stick in my mind of the kind of rewards of being able to do things like that for people.
Anything else happened that you recall from your... I don't know how many years were you out there for?
2.5 years.
Was that the whole of the short service commission, in essence?
Yeah, there was only a little bit left. And eventually, I was posted back to Catterick, actually.
So that would be 65 or
60? 65.
And anything else happened while you were out in Singapore that you recall of?
Oh, we went to Hong Kong regularly, as I told you, and that was where there were seasons, and it was really quite interesting. I thought Hong Kong was one of the most beautiful cities I'd ever seen. As we went in, it would be a Sunday afternoon, and the Convair 880 turned over on its side, and I could see down into the harbour, and I just didn't believe this. It looked like something magical. And then, of course, Hong Kong turned out to be pretty magical when you got there. Lived in a hotel. Said there ought to be a permanent ophthalmologist there. Got a chap called Malcolm Scott out. And he and I... Malcolm sort of nosed around Hong Kong, tried to find things to do. Got friendly with vets. And he and I actually operated on a horse. So that was just one of those sort of exciting little anecdotes. We dug a hole in a field in order to be able to operate on the horse's eye, and the vets got it to lie down, and the anaesthetist, who was a British Army anaesthetist, worked out a means of keeping this horse asleep while we did a corneal graft on it.
And it worked?
Well, it worked for a while. It went up peg, alas, but it was technically successful. And they wanted to keep the horse because it was a good riding horse.
Yeah, so, I mean, as you were approaching the end of your thing, did you think of extending your short service, you know, becoming a
Yeah,
a,
this
a
is
more
this
regular.
Is it. This was the point. I had to ask myself, you know, what there was in the army and what there was in civilian life. And once again, what had I done? I still hadn't got my final fellowship of the Royal College of Surgeons. And again, in order to get on any shortlist, you really needed these qualifications. I used to complain very bitterly about it because I'd passed all my exams until then, and this was one that, much to my surprise, proved very difficult.
What was your difficulty? I mean,
well, I was an eye specialist, and I had to know the detailed anatomy of the entire body, including the five layers of the foot and the intimate anatomy of the hand and all that sort of thing. And so it was really quite hard to pass exams where it was just a matter of stacking your memory with lots of facts which you made no use of whatsoever in daily life. And so that was tough. And I remember when I did pass in London, there was a Pole who was one of the anatomists from Edinburgh, actually, and I'd met him before, having failed in Edinburgh a few times. And there was a surgeon, a white-haired, rather curmudgeonly surgeon, and he examined me in London. And the surgeon asked me about some of the intimate anatomy of the belly, which, of course, general surgeons are very accurately acquainted with all these things, and I clearly didn't impress him. And the Pole said to me, "Tell me, doctor, what is your specialty?" And I said, "Ophthalmology." And he said, "Ah, head on neck." So we went to a bit of prosected body, head and neck and so on, and the old white-haired old gent wandered off. He wasn't really very much interested in me. And I was asked questions by this Pole, and clearly made the right impression, because he shouted over the room, the examination room, to the white-haired old chap. He said, "Come here," he said. "He knows very well head and neck." How does that man manage to retain that kind of accent and syntax after many years in this country? But nevertheless, with such a characteristic voice stuck in my mind. And that's how I got through the exam. Now, at that time, you see, I'd more or less committed myself to permanent commission.
Now, how did you actually get a permanent commission? What did you do to get it?
Just simply applied. And can I convert to a permanent commission? And they said yes. And then I got some of the privileges that went with it, like a quarter and so on.
Now, so what was your next move? You got it before you left Singapore, or?
No, this was in Catterick. Thinking in Catterick, you know, what to do.
Where were you at Catterick?
Here. Well, it's the Catterick Military Hospital, the old one. And we were in a quarter in Hague Road, which is in the north end of camp. And very happy time there, children growing up, going to school. What I did in Catterick was to treat the locals as well. So I did cataracts and glaucoma and the sort of thing, because the people around Catterick regarded Catterick Military Hospital as their hospital. A lot of them went there rather than going to Darlington. And I saw a much more normal range of eye conditions.
How are they treating glaucoma and cataracts? I mean, cataracts are a lot, I mean, what were they doing at the time?
What I was doing at the time would be what's called intracapsular extraction. That is, you take out the entire lens and correct it with glasses afterwards. And glaucoma, standard sort of decompression operations of various sorts, pyridinclysis and trephines and so on.
Did you like the greater variety?
I welcomed it back, but I'd really got, I suppose, making a virtue out of necessity, I'd really got quite interested in squints and tried to understand them. I don't think anyone can really make a great deal of progress towards squints because it's much, very much a sort of complex thing. It isn't as simple as it looks, you might say. The eyes don't point in the same direction. But after that, it gets incredibly complicated to understand and to interfere with constructively. You can straighten them, but basically they're still squinting. All you've done is alter the direction of their eyes. But in there, you haven't altered it at all. The brain may adjust to the interference that you've imposed on it, but you haven't really changed very much in the way of squint physiology, you might say. Cataract, what we were doing was removing cataracts at that time. Everybody was, no one else was doing that. Intraocular lenses, despite the fact that they're now standard, they had come and gone. A chap called Harold Ridley, who died quite recently, he thought of the idea of intraocular lenses based on his experiences in the war. Did you know about this? Now, Harold Ridley is an eye specialist at St. Thomas's Hospital, and he observed during the war that airmen who had fragments of the cockpit embedded in their eyes got little reaction from them. Perspex, in other words, was biologically inactive. And he thought, well, if it's optically clear and biologically inactive, why don't I put another lens in instead of the lens I've taken out, an intraocular lens? And he did. And to a certain extent, it worked. He put the Perspex lens, which was modeled on the normal lens, put it in, and it was supported by fibrous tissue, which he created by means of a particular technique of cataract extraction, extracapsular extraction, done in the standard way, and it worked quite well. The trouble was they were heavy, and they tended to slide down or come out through the pupil. But a lot of them worked. He had a degree of success. On the other hand, insufficient worked for it to take off, and so it went out of consideration. It was still desirable, but that was an unsuccessful attempt, or rather not sufficiently successful attempt to do it. And it wasn't until very lightweight intraocular lenses were invented, designed by Russians and Americans, that it became much more popular, and now it's completely standard.
Now, what about your life as a... Well, you were an officer now. Was there much of an officer's mess life for you?
Yeah, it was hospital, RMC officer's mess. It wasn't very much like infantry messes that I'd experienced in the TA 6th Battalion. It was really just a place where officers met and lunched and so on. It was... There was a certain amount of mess life in Singapore, where we had a Sunday curry tiffin, as they called it, when we all gathered round and ate an enormous quantity of curry and drank an enormous quantity of beer and slept it off in the heat of Singapore. But in England, there wasn't very much like that. There was the occasional mess night where people would play cribbage and so on. Other kinds of games, sometimes with the sergeant's mess, things like that.
Did you see much of a career in promotion within the army at this time when you were at Catterick? You'd taken your permanent commission, but I mean, did you see yourself progressing?
I don't know. It's I don't really know what I had in mind, quite honestly. I just found it was comfortable to be like that. I knew that I would get promoted. I didn't particularly want to be advisor in ophthalmology, which was the top position. That would involve being in London. I think what I wanted to do was to travel again. Because I took a permanent commission, I was offered a sabbatical year, you might call it, and that was a posting to the ophthalmic hospital in Jerusalem.
Now, when was that? How long were you at Catherine?
That would be 1968. I went August 1968. I went to the ophthalmic hospital of St. John in Jerusalem, and that was a tremendous year. It was just after the Six-Day War, and East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem were open. The wall was down. The Mandelbaum Gate no longer existed, although his premises did. And in East Jerusalem, they were sort of not quite sure what was going to happen. They had no idea what the future held. But the hospital, which had been established a long time, was almost exclusively for Arabs and was very busy.
And it was all eyes?
It was all eyes, an ophthalmic hospital. And I must have seen about 25,000 people, something like that, personally. It was extremely busy. I did 444 cataracts that year, and appropriate numbers of other conditions. They flew out some corneas from East Grinstead and did some corneal grafts. It was a full-time, busy ophthalmic practice, and as I say, more or less exclusively for a Arab population, because it had been before the Six-Day War. People from Gaza could get to the hospital then, and it was extremely difficult for them to get there before. It had a worldwide international reputation and was particularly respected.
Do you feel you learnt?
Oh, tremendous amount. A very absolutely transforming experience.
Well, what exactly did
because
you learn?
West Jerusalem
was it just practice, or were you learning new techniques?
Oh no, it was there wasn't anything particularly new. Let's see, retinal detachments. I suppose I consolidated some of my detachment surgery there, because retinal detachment surgery had been done with, I think my wife will probably get it. Retinal detachment surgery had been done by looking in the eye close to, and there's another technique called indirect ophthalmoscopy where you put a kind of hat on with a mirror and you can look at the eye a long way away, and you can actually operate more directly. There was a lot of guesswork involved in techniques that I was brought up on, but I could practice these more direct techniques on detachments in Jerusalem, and I learned how to do that much more competently.
Now, were you much aware of any tension in Israel? Arab-Israel?
No, there wasn't an awful lot going on. There was a kind of lull after the Six-Day War where nobody was quite sure what was going to happen or what should happen. The Israelis had ideas, and I made lots of Israeli friends because there was freedom of movement between East and West Jerusalem. And we used to go to the Hadassah Hospital, where an old Glaswegian called Michelson was professor of ophthalmology there. And we used to go once a week to his sessions, his grand ward rounds. So we were in contact with international class ophthalmology, as well as practicing rural ophthalmology on our own on the eastern side. Discussions naturally took place as to what should happen. We were aware of the propositions made by Abba Iban and so on, talking about being trying to unify the country, being magnanimous in victory, as he said, all that kind of thing. But I wasn't aware of it as much at the time as I became later. That was this curious puzzlement that the Israelis had. They couldn't quite understand why the Arabs rejected their offers. And it's fairly obvious now, it wasn't even obvious to me then, that what they were offering the Arabs, the Palestinians, was a kind of second-class citizenship. And they were hurt that the Arabs wouldn't accept this. And I suppose it was the sort of euphoria of victory against the might of the Arab states surrounding them, much against even perhaps their own expectations. They were victorious, and that they had this curious euphoria that anything they said would be welcomed by the Arabs. It wasn't, of course.
Now, you were out there from 68 to 69.
Yes.
Anything else happened, or anything in particular?
No, it was just a very busy time, and again, a tremendously educative experience.
Now, where did you come back to?
Germany, to BMH Rintelen.
Where, sorry?
Rintelen, which is near Hanover.
Rintelen.
R-I-N-T-E-L-N, Rintelen. That was a military hospital, and the major one in North Germany, a major army military hospital in North Germany.
And what were you doing? Obviously, probably.
It was an old. The building itself was Nazi. It was an old SS or Gestapo hospital, it had been taken over in 1945 and was established as British forces hospital there. And once again, the practice involved travelling to Hanover and Berlin, and was largely concerned with families.
As travelling clinics again then?
Yes. I did Berlin, Hanover, Münster, and the RAF had the hospital at Rheindahl and Wegberg, I think it was. There were the two major hospitals, and there was a BMH in Berlin, but it was always visiting eye specialists, as it was in Hong Kong.